Part 1 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Dr. Heller's Exploration of Jung's Red Book Begins, Background and Book 1, Chapter 1.
Now just a little comment about the book itself. If you were not informed concerning its theme, you wouldn't be here. So it's not important for me to reiterate that. To our great joy, and after many trepidations and expectations, the book has actually been published, and there have been some very exciting events in connection with the launching of it in New York, where an exhibit at the Rubin Museum, which houses the exhibit of the Red Book. An original copy of the Red Book is there. Various, I think there are about 3 of the notebooks that are collectively called the Black Books that are there, and many other objects which have to do with the Red Book. And the leadership of the Philemon Foundation was there, as well as far as I know, just about all of C.G. Jung's grandchildren, who are comprised now the family council, were there. It was a very joyous occasion. And the editor of the book gave a talk upon its publication, which was held, I believe, at the New York Medical Academy, where over 500 people were present. It was very, very successful. And many of these lectures and events are available in various forms on the internet, if you look them up. But, of course, the forces of spiritual wickedness in various places, including high places, always intrude. And so there was a major glitch subsequent to the publication, and that was that only 5,000 copies were printed by W.W. Norton Company, and these proved utterly inadequate to even the orders that have been placed weeks and weeks ago. And so it is just sort of depends upon your synchronicity or luck if you ordered one, whether you received one or not. We were almost cheated out, at least for the time being, of our own copy for our purposes, because the copy that was ordered for our use did not arrive. However, I don't mind telling you, although I will do so without naming any names, that one of our very dear friends and donors purchased one on the sly for $500. And that is what you see here. You don't see it because I got it covered up, so you don't see it here. Right. It's so expensive, we won't let you look at it. At least not at this moment, a bit later. In any event, thus we received the copy Monday of this last week, and so I had some opportunity to study it. When I saw the book for the first time, I was reminded of a passage in the famous hymn, which is the traditional ancient hymn for November the 2nd, for All Souls Day, the Dies Irae, in which there is one line which reads, and I read it to you also in honor of Carl Jung's classical knowledge in Latin, Liber scriptus proferetur in quo totum continetur unde mundus judicetur. But I'll take pity on you and translate it. The handwritten book is opened, in which all is contained, and the world in it is judged. And I found it to be applicable so far to this work. Also, Dr. Sonu Shamdasani, the valiant and great editor of this work, who has worked on the Red Book almost without pause for about 13 years, I believe, has made a few statements which I think are very helpful and certainly very applicable. This is one: there can be few unpublished works that have already exerted such far-reaching effects upon 20th century social and intellectual history as Jung's Red Book or Liber Novus which is really Jung's name for it, meaning the new book, nominated by Jung to contain the nucleus of his later works. It has long been recognized as the key to comprehending the Genesis. Yet, aside from a few tantalizing glimpses, it has remained unavailable for study. Indeed, it has been. Another element which the good editor, the valiant editor, brings forth in his introduction, and I will not spend hardly any more time on the introduction, but I think some of these glimpses are quite important, is one of which I was only to a very small extent cognizant until now. And that is the fact that the first few decades of the 20th century, as he said, saw a strange convergence of literature and psychology, which has subsequently ebbed away and has never really returned. And he lists a very large number of psychologists and psychiatrists of that time, the great pioneers like Binet and Richet and Fechner and Flournoy and quite a few others. All of these people wrote not only textbooks on psychology or psychiatry, but they wrote poetry, they wrote novels, some of them pseudonymously, and along with that, they also used all sorts of what now we would consider highly unconventional means of contacting what subsequent to Freud came to be called the unconscious. All of these highly qualified and extremely reputable men, whose name has entered the honorable rolls of psychology, organized seances, cultivated all manner of altered states of consciousness, including crystal gazing and others, so that most anything that they could lay their hands on and that promised to bring them and some of their associates into extraordinary states of consciousness was highly sought by them and was practiced by them. So that when Jung, within the first couple of decades of the 20th century, began writing what subsequently became the Red Book or the Liber Novus, he wasn't that much out in line, in fact wasn't out in line at all with what would seem the overwhelming majority of his profession. No doubt there were some, including Sigmund Freud, who didn't quite go that way. But we must also remember that along with various other unusual activities, Freud was intensely fascinated by the quote occult. Everybody knows that who had dealings with Freud's literature. And he had a sort of a highly ambivalent attitude toward it. He went back and forth, but the interest was certainly there. And for our purposes, I think it's useful to keep in mind that the reason for this was not just that all of these people were what in the vernacular we might call weirdos, but rather that they were highly motivated explorers of the mind, who tried to use such modalities of exploration as appeared promising to them. That this has changed subsequently, that is true. But it certainly was very much in the picture at that particular time. So what Jung did, and the activities that resulted in the writing of the Red Book, was by no means extraordinary or highly unusual or heretical or disreputable at that particular time in his profession. And this, I think, is really important to remember. Now, the intense confrontation with a very deep and very powerful kind of interior imagery, which he underwent pretty much at the time And immediately subsequent to the terrible time of World War I, actually, heralded itself by some events in his life and particularly his inner life earlier. So that by 1912, which was the time when he finished his seminal work, called in German Wandlungen und Symbole der Libido, The Transformations and Symbols of the Libido, nowadays available as Symbols of Transformation, right as he finished writing that particular book, there occurred dreams of an unusual nature and number, which, as he very honestly said, he failed to understand at the time. One was that of a knight in armor who had on his back a red Maltese cross. No mention of that is made in Sonu Shamdasami's introduction, but the red Maltese cross is the emblem of only one knightly order, and that is the Knights Templar, who hold a certain interest to many of us here. And also, subsequently, he had an involved dream containing a white bird who came to visit him, a white dove, in fact, which in turn, if we want to go that far, also has some highly important symbolic significance, not only the common Christian iconographic one of the Holy Spirit, but let's say of certain esoteric transmissions such as those of the Cathars in the south of France, whose most important sign of recognition by now is the white dove. It was his encounter with the white dove in his dream that also influenced him for establishing a lifelong close association with his former patient and then colleague Antonia Wolf. By that time, 1912-1913, he was keeping a set of dated diary-like books. I sort of like to call them, owing to a nomenclature of another tradition, things like magical diaries, which came to be called the Black Books, because they were written in notebooks with a black cover. He called these books records of, as he said, records of my most difficult experiment. This experiment seems to have begun in December 1913. I will only mention one more statement about this, which is in Dr. Shamdasani's introduction. He said, and it's not entirely clear, but it looks to me like it is a quotation from Jung, that this experiment had to do, and this is at least a quotation from the book, with the background activity of the psyche, for he wanted to give this background activity the possibility of emerging just as one does when taking mescaline. Now, mescaline, of course, was known by that time because peyote was known for a very long time. Jung, as far as we know, has never partaken of psychedelics. He said to Lawrence van der Post that if he did do so, he really would fear for himself because he was subject to the spontaneous intrusion into his consciousness of very powerful unconscious imagery all the time, and so that he did not need to stimulate that, right? But let's say the analogy or the near analogy between starting this process by some other means and by that means is interesting. It's highly interesting to me that that statement is made in this book. Between November 1913 and January 1914, there also appeared first in a dream the figure that is subsequently so powerfully connected with the Red Book. in our discussion this evening, he will not yet have appeared, although he has made an appearance by that time, but he is not in this part of the book yet, and that is, of course, the mysterious being whom Jung called Philemon. He saw him first in a dream, and Philemon came flying through the sky over the lake of Zurich on the wings of a kingfisher. At first he had horns like a bull, and he carried keys, a bundle of keys. One pointed to open a lock. And this was, of course, the lock that opened up the door to the mysterious kingdom within which Jung journeyed then for such a long time. The first entry in Jung's black books about Philemon is on January the 27th, 1914. I will not spend any more time at this point, although I may introduce some of these data later on with this introductory material, but I also wish to state that it certainly appears from the statements that are quoted in Dr. Shandasamy's introduction that Jung considered the work that he was thus doing, and about which he was in contact with a number of disciples, as having been closely related to the, as he called it, the Helleno-Egyptian spirit of Gnosticism and Neoplatonism. So let's say the Gnostic element was there and was mentioned by Jung and was recognized by him at a very early period of the material. Now we come to the book itself. The first portion of the Liber Novus, the new book, is called Liber Primus. These are all Latin names. You must keep in mind that people who went to schools in those days all knew Latin and also Greek. So in the first book, on the first page, its title declares the Vague des Commenden. This is the title of the first book, the Liber Primus, which means the way of what is to come, which identifies it right at that point in the title as having a prophetic tone in more ways than one. Since I'm sure that the element and the appellation of prophet and prophecy will be very commonly applied from now on to Jung and to his work, particularly this work, it's important for us to call to attention to the fact that the primary meaning of prophet is someone who is in touch with the divine. There are prophetic religions in this world, such as Judaism and Islam and Zoroastrianism and Mormonism, and all of these have as their founders, or at least quite a few of their founders, as in the case of Judaism, prophets. These prophets are interlocutors of and communicators with divinity. That's the primary meaning of prophet. However, there is, of course, a secondary meaning which has sort of snuck into the vernacular in a big way, and that is that a prophet foretells the future, which is usually the area where most prophets then fall down and discredit themselves, because the future so seldom turns out the way it is predicted. Wherefore, I would advise all of you to stay away from that kind of prophetic activity, even if you are tempted to do so. However, in the case of C.G. Jung, we must admit that this predictive element is also present. But for the most part, it is present in the form of predicting spiritual trends and spiritual events that are to come in the history of the world, and more particularly in the individual histories of the psyches of the minds of various people. And so that is important to keep in mind. Now there is something a little bit interesting, at least it was to me, because in notes that I had taken in 1975 at the Panarion Conference, as it was called here in Los Angeles, which was held on the 100th anniversary of C.G. Jung's birth, a statement was made by Professor Quispel, as I recall, now here my memory has to enter the picture, and supported by the late great early founding father of the Jungians in Los Angeles, Dr. James Kirsch. And what they said was, and these are the words that I wrote down, this sounds rather like Quispel's type of English, since he was a Dutchman. After the split with Freud, at a lonely, critical time of his life, C.G. Jung opened his mother's Bible, and he read from Isaiah. And here was the quotation. And there shall be a highway and a way, and a holy way shall it be called, a straight way, so that fools shall not err therein. Now, the curious circumstance is, and sort of interesting to me at least, is that the first book, The Way of What is to Come, starts with several quotations from the Bible. They are all in Latin, these biblical quotations, and the first two are from Isaiah, then one from the first chapter of the Gospel of John, and then from Isaiah again. Now, I certainly don't need to thump the Bible here for you, even if the Bible is in the red book. But let's see, when you look over all of these quotations, you find that they all really have to do with foretelling the coming of the Messiah and of messianic events to a great extent. And the quotations end with the very short two-line quotation which I just gave you, and there shall be a highway and a way. So that is included and concludes these biblical quotations which we have there. And then when the quotations are finished, we have the little, in small letters in the handwriting of Jung, also in Latin, written by C.G. Jung by his own hand in his house in Küsnacht, Zurich, in the year 1915. All of the above being in Latin. I will reserve, I think, the describing to you the beautiful little picture which is in the initial letter of the first book. There, let me just say this much, that while it looks like just a lovely little landscape when you look at it first, it really reveals itself as in a low-key sort of a way, as a layered cosmos, which extends from the underworld to the highest heavens. All of that is in there. And then the vertical bar of the great D with which the book and the chapter starts has something else. It has a vessel with fire, and out of the fire, more or less, there rises with many twists and turns a gigantic serpent that goes all the way up toward the heavens, and that bears a crown, like the basilisk of old, the crowned serpent. So make of it at this point what you wish, but that is really the beginning of the book. And at this point, I think I will now refer to the great book myself by getting it here in front of me closer. My good friend will do that. I will, of course, read from the translations, from the translated text, but as you probably have guessed, those of you who don't know already, I speak German. It was my second language in the cradle. I grew up speaking Hungarian and German both, and so I have the opportunity to go back from time to time and look at the German text, especially where it's fairly legible, being in this beautiful calligraphy of Jung, which is a calligraphy that he never used, as far as we know, for any other purpose but for this book. It's very medieval looking, and then has these beautifully illuminated letters, initial letters. And in those few times where I have checked, for some reason, I have found the translation very, very accurate, very, very good. I almost am almost tempted to say, if that wouldn't sort of impugn my humility, I couldn't have done it better myself. All right. So after the quotations from scripture, all of which have a very messianic kind of powerful prophetic tone. Of course, the prophecies from Isaiah are attributed by Christian biblical exegesis as being predictions about the coming of Jesus. But they are, of course, just the predictions of coming of a Messiah, a messianic impulse, something that would happen that would make the world and people in it very different from what they have been before. But the quotation from the first chapter of John, of course, is different. Now then, let me read to you, therefore, the first portion of book 1, where the text itself begins. If I speak in the spirit of this time, I must say no one and nothing can justify what I must proclaim to you. Justification is superfluous to me, since I have no choice, but I must. I must. I have learned that in addition to the spirit of this time, there is still another spirit at work, namely that which rules the depths of everything contemporary. The emphasis is on the depths, on the deep, the Tiefe in German, you know. The spirit of this time would like to hear of use and value. I also thought this way, and my humanity still thinks this way. But that other spirit forces me nevertheless to speak beyond justification, use, and meaning. Filled with human pride and blinded by the presumptuous spirit of the times, I long sought to hold that other spirit away from me. But I did not consider that the spirit of the depths from time immemorial and for all the future possesses a greater power than the spirit of this time, who changes with the generations. The spirit of the depths has subjugated all pride and arrogance to the power of judgment. He took away my belief in science. He robbed me of the joys of explaining and ordering things, and he let devotion to the ideals of this time die out in me. Could he but do it to a few other people, I know. He forced me down to the last and simplest things. The spirit of the depths took my understanding and all my knowledge and placed them at the service of the inexplicable and the paradoxical. He robbed me of speech and writing for everything that was not in his service, namely the melting together of sense and nonsense, which produces the supreme meaning. But the supreme meaning is the path, the way, and the bridge to what is to come. That is the God yet to come. It is not the coming God himself, but his image, which appears in the supreme meaning. God is an image, and those who worship him must worship him in the images of the supreme meaning. I will stop at that particular point, because this is, of course, this is the great beginning, this is the great start, and it is not only a start, but startling, as well, if you don't mind me punning in that particular fashion. So, two spirits, the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. Now, when seeing the spirit of the times, one is immediately reminded of a very, what has become a very popular German word, you know, for a long time, Zeitgeist, because Zeit is time, Geist is spirit. But that's not the one that Jung uses, and I think that only to a minor extent does he mean that. He means something else. What he says is the spirit of the times, which is probably to a large extent the spirit of the 20th century, maybe more precisely of the early part of the 20th century where he is living. But if I read this correctly, which is anybody's guess, even mine, I think it also applies to a great extent to our time. Now, we have to keep in mind that there are 94 years, if I figure correctly, which I very seldom do, because I all my life detested mathematics, and I still do. You know, the spirit of the depths has taken my interest in science away early in life, very early in life, to the great unhappiness of my teachers in school. But that's neither here nor there. In any event, we need to keep that in mind. Yet it would seem that when it comes to the salient points that he mentions, that our times are not that much different, at least in these respects, in spirit, from the ones that Jung seemingly lived in at that time. So we have these two apparently in conflict with each other, the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths, which is a good free translation, but actually the German that he uses, the spirit of the deep, which maybe is a little more dramatic than of the depths. I don't know. It depends on what drama turns you on. In any event, I think from a psychological point of view, we might say that the spirit of the depths is definitely the spirit of the unconscious, but in a very, very profound, in a very ultimate fashion, because anybody who has, you know, studied depth psychology to any degree will probably agree with me that there is an unconscious, and then there is an unconscious, and then there is yet another unconscious. And we certainly don't have access to all of them. Initially, we don't have access to any, because otherwise they wouldn't be unconscious. Right? Das Bewusste und das Unbewusste, you know, in German. But certainly what we are dealing with here is really the deep. The deep unconscious, if you want to put it that way, in a very, very great depth. It's kind of a deep power and the wisdom of the deep. So he indicates that this deep power is non-rational, non-utilitarian. It wants to melt together sense and nonsense, for that is what produces, it puts it, supreme meaning. So obviously the spirit of the times deals with a very superficial kind of meaning. It wants to hear use and value. Use, of course, is, well, utilitarianism. People always ask that, either openly or in their minds, what use is it? What good is it? What's in it for me? Yeah. See, this is the spirit of the times. What's in it for me? And this takes all kinds of forms, you know, this kind of thinking, but it's always there. And value, well, there are different kinds of value, but certainly sort of monetary value is probably not to be excluded. That's what the spirit of the times thinks of. It's a worldly spirit. And so the world, this worldly spirit says, I can use it for my personal aggrandizement and things of that sort. And this extroverted, ego-motivated, utilitarian, pragmatic, egotistical spirit, that is the spirit of the times. That's not a bad judgment, I think, of our own times either. As a Tibetan teacher, the late Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche wrote, even our spirituality is materialistic, spiritual materialism. Now, you can't get much more into Jung's spirit of the times than that. But then, of course, is, as we mentioned already, the spirit of the depths. And so this is very different. Of course, you have to kind of get used to it, because this is, it's almost a little bit disturbing, especially as he goes on later on. He continues to emphasize that in order to arrive at this extremely important, great, new meaning, you see, there has to be a mixing and a blending of what to us appear to be very disparate and even contradictory elements, sense and nonsense, and many others. We'll see later on, you know, there's some wonderful passages about how important an ingredient in this mixture of ultimate meaning, I'm using my own word there, for instance, the element of the funny, of the humorous, of the laughable is, that somehow without that laughable quality, there is no real meaning. Now, there is a lot of very solemn kind of puritanical folk who would be very upset by that, but then no doubt they need to be upset. And you know, I mean, he was in Switzerland too. You know, let's face it, was it in The Third Man that somebody says, well, the only thing Switzerland ever produced was cuckoo clocks? Well, it produced Carl Jung for one at the human level and others, but let's say, you know, there is definitely a harsh puritanical spirit there, which is not anything like the lightheartedness, the laughter of the Mediterranean spirit. It's something very different. So he was very conscious of that. And now, let's say, he indicates, therefore, that the supreme meaning, which is what he uses, needs to have this kind of blending of these contradictory elements. It's a prefiguration, actually, and I'm mentioning this for an important reason. It's a prefiguration of what later on occurs in Jung's studies of alchemy, the reconciliation of the opposites. And it was precisely, now I'm getting very much ahead of myself, but it's worth mentioning, that Jung stopped writing the Red Book when he came upon alchemy. Very strange. But we'll come to that, you know, later. But the reason apparently being, he said, aha, here I can express the insight, the revelation, the illumination that I have received, here I can express it in an allegorical way that will not rob people as raw as if I told it to them directly from the Red Book. And so he went over to alchemy and he worked on that for quite a long time. But of course the Red Book was there and then he came back to it. But you can see why. Because in alchemy is the, well, how should we put it, the toned down, the disguised gnosis of the Red Book, which people responded to quite nicely and often still do. It's also important to keep in mind that there's really opposite here, that Jung, of course, also stated on the basis of his researches, and I think it's historically true, at least it's very plausible, that he pinpointed a particular alchemist, a Greco-Egyptian alchemist of Gnostic background, Zosimos of Panopolis, who, he said, changed the symbolism of the Gnostic religion into alchemy. And that is how it continued. Well, according to the Red Book, in a certain way, and not in lieu of the historical figure, but in his own time, Jung was Zosimos of Panopolis at a certain point. Very, very amazing. And so he indicates here, and I'm now summarizing some of the other parts of this passage, that a new God image is coming. You already heard that. And the supreme meaning, which is the meaning brought about by a gnosis, we might say, proceeding from the spirit of the depths, the supreme meaning is the path and the way and the bridge to that divine image. So something is coming, but we in ourselves have to attain to contact with that supreme meaning in order to be aware of what is coming in the collective, as we would call it nowadays. Jung also brings up the concept later on of the shadow of the image of God. Now this is a bit confusing because it appears from the context, and others will perhaps disagree with me, that what he is talking about here is not to be interpreted as shadow in the sense of later Jungian psychological terminology. It's not the dark or the unlived or the evil side of the divine image or the image of God. It is more like a terrestrial reflection. But the issue is that it is an inaccurate reflection. When he talks here about the shadow of God, it's not a good reflection. He says that the shadow is nonsense. Yet he continues by saying, of course, that nonsense is the undying and inseparable brother of the supreme being. Now, these things are paradoxical, and if you are not very comfortable with paradoxes, then you're going to be very uncomfortable with this book. But hopefully you are, you know. But you know, Alan Watts of blessed memory was one to say at in the very first lecture that I heard from Alan when he first came here from back east, he said, "Everything is deadly serious and hilariously funny at the same time." And you know, I never forgot that. That's how I'm able to tell it to you. With all the things that I forget, that's one sentence I never forgot. So, you see, here Jung begins to show in this chapter, he begins to show his great regard for irony, nonsensicalness, balderdash, as vital ingredients of the ultimately real, of the ultimately meaningful. Well, there are many things in here which, if one has not experienced them, at least to some extent, one can't really relate to them. And so there is this, I assure you, when you get your own copy or whatever happens, or you hit the lottery and then you get your own copy, you know, whichever way it's going to go and so forth, there is going to be a great deal in here that you cannot relate to, don't worry, because you would have to be Carl Jung himself to relate to this. And you know what? Carl Jung himself is not among us. Right now, his spirit maybe is, but you know, it wouldn't work. But on the other hand, if you experience some of this, then you will know exactly what I'm talking about. And I think that there are some here who know when I say that the incredible power, the releasing and transformative and creative power of the funny. Of the funny, I can't express it really in any other way, is something that in certain rare, unusual states of consciousness we experience. And it's an incredible thing. And then he refers to also the things that are little, which are generally regarded as insignificant, are brought to his attention that everything is important. All these so-called little things are important. And he particularly resents that. Well, why? Because a great man doesn't like to bother with little things, I think. That's very, very simple. And you don't even have to be that great. I certainly don't claim to be great myself, but let me tell you the malice of little things, the unconscionable hostility and malice of small physical objects. It's something that I've experienced all my life, and it annoys the living daylights out of me. Hardly anything annoys me more than that. And so Jung really didn't like that statement, and he said, I had to swallow the small as a means of healing the immortal in me. Because the spirit of the depth says, you have to take these, you have to pay attention to these things. The smallness is regarded, he says, he is generally regarded in the world and by him as inglorious and unheroic. Now what a wonderful choice of words. And these are good translations from the German here. Inglorious and unheroic, and yet he has to swallow it and deal with it. You know, we say colloquially, the devil is in the details. But he is telling us the supreme meaning is also in the details. The spirit of the depths makes him drink the bitter drink of detail, of smallness, of minusculeness. Now one needs to understand this sort of thing and not merely try to explain it. Here again, I think people who have experienced various forms of altered states of consciousness for one reason or the other, you know, will agree with me that there come some moments in your process where all of a sudden the little, the small, the minuscule, something not larger than a cell itself, geez, you know, look what a marvel, look what an incredible thing, look how much meaning is locked up in these tiny little things. So the main central point continues now with the two spirits. The spirit of the depths continues to emphasize that ridiculousness is part of the supreme meaning. This is what I mentioned before. You will recognize that the supreme meaning is laughter and worship at once. Now, one is reminded of the laughter of the Olympian gods, and there is one minor Greek myth, which was explored by a German writer in the 19th century, I think Hermann Usner, where Hermes laughs the world into being. He starts laughing, and as the result of his laughter, things, you know, come into existence. Then Jung says, he receives mercy. Well, mercy in this sense is what in religion we call a gratuitous gift of grace. This grace or mercy allows him to overcome his resistance to the spirit of the depths. You see, sometimes something has to break through and helps you over the hump, so to say. Here he is, he is resisting and arguing with this spirit, but then something comes to him that allows him not to do that anymore. And in the latter portion then of the chapter, he recounts several visions he had in symbolic language of the beginning of World War I. Now this I need to explain a little, and I'm not going to read those, but they are mentioned, some of these things are mentioned very, very briefly, all too briefly in the truncated form in Memories, Dreams and Reflections. And this one is definitely mentioned. So, beginning in October 1913, and then about 2 weeks later, then in several dreams in June and July of 1914, Jung received a series of extremely ominous and frightening scenes, which all had to do with something very dire happening in the world and more particularly in Europe. And this worried him a great deal. And he said so in his autobiographical fragments, and says so here, that one of his concerns, since he was a psychiatrist himself, was that he may be on the verge of being swamped by the forces of the unconscious to the point that he will go under, his consciousness will go under, that he may suffer from schizophrenia or something like that. Because some of the images were vast floods. One was a vast flood of water that covered practically all of Europe. But it couldn't come over the mountains into Switzerland. And then there was a vast flood of blood. And then the concluding images all had to do with an incredible cold, horribly cold temperature that came from outer space and that descended on the world and froze everything. The oceans were all full of ice, and all the green growing things had frozen, had withered. But then he discovers a tree, which is also pretty much beat up. It doesn't have any leaves on it anymore, and it's sort of a sad excuse for a tree. But on the tree, there is some fruit. And it's something like grapes. It's extremely sweet. And he's really overjoyed by that, and he starts picking off the sweet fruits and giving it to people. And so that kind of ends on the series of strange, terrifying, ominous experiences end on a good note. And then, not only that, but then came World War, the war declarations of World War I. And Jung said, aha, it did not talk about me. It talked about Europe. It talked about the world. It was a symbolic series of precognitive experiences. That's what it was about. And this is literally what gave him permission to go into the depths now and then write the text that became the Red Book. Because now he knew that what was happening to him was not in the nature of a psychotic episode, but in the nature of a predictive series of visions. That doesn't mean that everything else that he experienced was predictive, but these were. And this encouraged him, and then he was able to go ahead. Then there was another lengthy passage addressed to readers, because see, this is, to a large extent, this is how the Red Book is put together. There comes a revelatory, often very poetic, very visionary passage. And then there come passages in which Jung, or sometimes someone else, Philemon or somebody else, is sort of amplifying the passages. It isn't really explain it 1, 2, 3, but amplifies it in the ways so that it is easier to deal with it. And here, in this portion, let me take a look at that one. This is after he recounts the experiences that preceded World War I, and now is another sort of declarative, revelatory portion. He says here, "My path is not your path. Therefore, I cannot teach you." He tells people, "I'm not teaching, I'm doing something else. The way is within us, but not in gods, nor in teachings, nor in laws. Within us is the way, the truth, and this life. Woe betide those who live by way of examples. Life is not with them. If you live according to an example, you thus live the life of that example. But who should live your own life if not yourself? So live yourselves. The signposts have fallen. Unblazed trails lie before us. Do not be greedy to gobble up the fruits of foreign fields. Do you not know that you yourselves are the fertile acre which bears everything that avails you? Yet who today knows this?
Who knows the way to the eternally fruitful climes of the soul? You seek the way through mere appearances. You study books and give ear to all kinds of opinion. What good is all that? Oh dear, how much we still need that statement, let me tell you. There is only one way, and that is your way. You seek the path. I warn you away from my own. It can also be the wrong way for you. May each go his own way. And then it goes further. So it's a caveat in a way to, you know, don't take my material literally. The important thing is that you find your own way in your own soul. Now comes a chapter, and I can't do too much of it. This is really, I think, where the sublime beauty begins. So I have to at least read the beginning of this to you, maybe more. This is really chapter one, because what I read to you thus far was sort of the prologue or the introductory portion of book one. Now comes chapter one of book one, which is entitled Refinding the Soul. Rediscovering the soul, finding the soul again. Jung indicates that all this came to him beginning with the vision of the flood in October 1913. That is the vision concerning the beginning of World War I. He was in his 40th year of his life. He was a well-situated man, lacking no worldly thing, and having every human happiness. And then, look what is happening to me. That kind of thing. We are perhaps reminded of Dante, who in midlife is led to a dark wood and then from there into the inner worlds, guided by Virgil. And you got to always remember that Virgil, you know, Publius Virgilius Maro was not only regarded as the greatest of poets in ancient Rome, but the greatest of magicians. And his first evaluation of Philemon, as we will see, is that Philemon is a magician. Well, he's that, but he's very much more, of course, too. So, and Faust and all of these figures, various historical and other figures, begin the mysterious inner journey. The spirit of the depths takes away his desire for these earthly trappings and drives him onward with unbearable inner longing. And now, we come, I think, to already a very, very, very fine passage. Yes, indeed. He goes looking for his soul. And this is how he speaks. My soul, where are you? Do you hear me? I speak. I call you. Are you there? I have returned. I'm here again. I have shaken the dust of all the lands from my feet, and I have come to you. I am with you. After long years of long wandering, I have come to you again. Should I tell you everything I have seen, experienced, and drunk in? Or do you not want to hear about all the noise of life in the world? But one thing you must know, the one thing I have learned, is that one must live this life. So he comes back again and again to this sort of existential emphasis that whatever you do, you know, you are here and you have to live this life. Only you can live your life. You have to live it with the greatest authenticity, with the greatest depth, with the greatest determination, and with as much wisdom as you can muster, which often isn't a heck of a lot. But he didn't say that. I said that. In any way, he continues. This life is the way, the long sought after way to the unfathomable, which we call divine. There is no other way. All other ways are false paths. I found the right way. It led me to you, to my soul. I return tempered and purified. Do you still know me? How long the separation lasted? Everything has become so different. And how did I find you? How strange my journey was. What words should I use to tell you on what twisted paths a good star has guided me to you? Give me your hand, my almost forgotten soul. How warm the joy of seeing you again, you long disavowed soul. Life has led me back to you. Let us thank the life I have lived for all the happy and all the sad hours, for every joy, for every sadness. My soul, my journey should continue with you. I will wander with you and ascend to my solitude. Sublimely beautiful passage, at least in my estimation. So, I think that probably with a little bit of exegesis of this, we will conclude. Jung then writes that it was really the spirit of the depths that forced him to say this, and you know earlier that he did not expect this. He had spoken much about the soul before, he says. I've been speaking about it all the time. I've been writing about it. I was talking about it in analysis. I was writing treatises and books. But you know, I mean, these are not the very words, but very similar. I really didn't know what the heck I was talking about, you know, because it says it was all false. He turned the soul into a scientific object, and this is a great sin. He had to become aware that he lost his soul. And he then gives a definition of the soul as prompted by the spirit of depths. And this, I think, is quite important. For this we learn how the spirit of the depths considers the soul. He sees her as a living and self-existing being. And with this he contradicts the spirit of this time, for whom the soul is a thing dependent on man. How true that is today. Now he would say the spirit of the time to whom the soul is a thing of the brain. All your brain research, all of this brain. Let me tell you, the best use I have of brain is fried calf brain. Well, I don't know, some of my friends said that if you fry your brain properly, it's not so bad either. But that's a 1960s statement, right? Okay. But you know, again, that it's just an epiphenomenon of the fleshly humanity. So, from the soul is a thing dependent on man, which lets herself be judged and arranged, and whose circumference we can grasp. I had to accept that what I had previously called my soul was not at all my soul, but a dead system. Hence I had to speak to my soul as to something far off and unknown, which did not exist through me, but through whom I existed. He whose desire turns away from outer things reaches the place of the soul. If he does not find the soul, the horror of emptiness will overcome him, and fear will drive him with a whip-lashing time and again in a desperate endeavor and a blind desire for the hollow things of the world. He becomes a fool through his endless desire and forgets the way of his soul never to find her again. He will run after all things and will seize hold of them, but he will not find his soul, since he would find her only in himself. Truly his soul lies in things and men, but the blind one seizes things and men, yet not his soul in things and men. He has no knowledge of his soul. How could he tell her apart from things and men? He could find his soul in desire itself, but not in the objects of desire. Look at the subtlety. How in the energy of a certain kind of desire, there are intimations of your soul, but not the object of the desire, because that sort of comes out of your own lower stupidity, shall we say. If he possessed his desire, and his desire did not possess him, He would lay a hand on his soul, since his desire is the image and expression of his soul. Now this, of course, is an old Gnostic idea that the human personality and the soul, the higher self, not the lower psyche, seek each other. In the Ginza of the Mandaeans, there is a long passage with many refrains, each ending with, I have no trust in the world. And then finally concluding with, in the whole world and its works I have no trust in the world. After my soul alone I go searching about, which to me is worth generations and worlds. I went and found my soul. What are all the worlds to me? Very, very true and very similar to what Jung says here. And I have also, perchance, discovered, printed on our Gnostic calendar, a statement of this from the soul's point of view by the modern Gnostic teacher, who was my teacher, the late Richard Duke de Palatine, who wrote, when the soul has developed to a certain point, it seeks to take over its human counterpart. And if the human counterpart is willing to allow this to happen, then the soul descends fully into the human personality and vouchsafes to it its wisdom. So we have here a wonderful image of the human, of the lesser human, of the human personality. Now, looking after and then finding his soul, as Jung, and then Jung, in this wonderful moving manner addressing the soul. Here you are. At last we have found each other. All the wrong paths that I have taken, all the byways and the cul-de-sacs into which I have entered, but now at last here you are. Now you need to keep in mind that this image of the duality of the lesser human and the soul, it's very ancient, it's very ubiquitous, and it appears again and again. Sure, the ancients technically had the tripartite division of body, soul, and spirit. But in this we have the duality, that what happens to us in life in this world here is that we lose our soul. And therefore what we need is to find that soul and to begin that dialogue of interaction with the soul. And there are wonderful dialogues that come in the pages. Oh, I think you'll be moved even as I was and will be moved again. And in these now the two come close together. And that is then truly the accomplishment of the path of wisdom. When that long lost companion, that sweet and wise and glorious and powerful and insightful other, like in the story of Eros and Psyche, comes together, and when the obstacles are finally removed, then all is well and all shall be well. And that is the beginning of redemption, that is the beginning of wisdom, that is the beginning of that ultimate, powerful, wonderful, redemptive meaning, which incidentally I think may be called Gnosis. Later on, not very far from this, Jung comes to repeat over and over again, the knowledge of the heart. Gnosis cardias, as it appears in the Gnostic scriptures. And all of this comes about as the result of the encounter and in the abiding relationship with the soul. And I very much hope that we will have the opportunity to see and hear more of that on the next occasion. So be sure to come back to us, and I thank you very much.
Catalog number 200501. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.